accession number 32502, Rule 4.
Tony Warwick, Rule 4. Tony, so obviously at this stage when you got into Sandgren, there was a lot on the TV the year before about the situation when the Paras were in Sandgren. How had it changed by the time you were there?
It was more like I said earlier in Northern Ireland, like one of them patrol bases sort of thing. There's protection all around now, because what I heard from before, the Paras didn't have no protection, they were just in the house. But this time now there's sandbag walls, and there's like big sangers all built and stuff, barbed wire going all around and stuff like that, and constant guards around there. And you had the guys like actually in the sanging house, like that, what you saw on the news and stuff, watching from there. And you have like NSC parties and air controllers up there and that stuff now, so it was pretty much more protected than it was in 2005 with the Paras.
And were the civilian population returning?
Yeah. Nothing from where that patrol base was. Everywhere you looked was just flat. There was no compounds, it was just like smashed to smithereens, everything was. Because obviously, if you remember watching the videos of 3PO, all the like air fire that went down in there and the mortar fire and stuff. I mean, everywhere it's just flat, everywhere. Just a bit like Kabul, how the city was and stuff. It just smashed to bits. Obviously, out when you come out of that part, you call that like the Wild West, so it's just crazy. As you come out of there, then the population is around and stuff. You need the police stations and people just doing their day in day thing with the markers and stuff like that.
So, how long were you in that for?
I was there for probably nearly a month doing stuff, doing that there, patrolling, and then you'd have a couple of days off. It was quite slow to start off with before the next lot start. And as soon as the next lot started, that's when everything changed up a bit.
Had you had many contacts at that stage? Was it?
I was just in M1s in Silicon. And then there was the odd shoot and scoop, but nothing really big, like, that was the first day I was out there, like in Silicon. It was just all pretty quiet, just the odd shot and run. You didn't even come anywhere near, you just hear it, just a crack in the night, you know, just crack on the moon.
So at that stage with the battalion, obviously in Silicon, had you kind of forced them back at that first stage, after that first day's encounter, really, you think?
Forced them back, and really that Silicon was just so the ANA then had bases that they could patrol out of and give them protection. And then there's a shower force going around from the ANA police around that local like town, that area where we actually were. That was what it was for. And then I don't know how to tell about it, but if they thought, oh right, okay. Or if they just shrugged their shoulders and just cracked them, which I think they did.
What about you? What was the kind of next stage for you?
R&R was coming up, so I had my R&R head on. But yeah, of course, the R&R, I had another week or so, I think it was, and we were doing patrolling down to the Salmon River and watching over the other side where there was all the caves and where we believed that that's where they'd run off to and stuff. We were looking for crossing points and stuff like that. Some contacts happened. I remember one being on Sky One with Ross Kemp, that major contact in the poppy field, that ambush. Yeah, I was in that one. That was when all hell broke loose again, and that's when they were calling mortar fire down on us. Oh my God, here we go. Again, and this time, obviously, this is the first time I've really been in a contact on foot, in the thick of it, and not on the high ground, calling in fire missions. So yeah, I was there, like, calling in fire missions, trying to pinpoint the enemy and stuff. Obviously, I had my Alpha MSC doing the same, and all just the good thing about like the MSC's job, the main thing was communication. We just had to keep communication going and giving sit reps and letting know where people are and stuff like that. So that was the main role for us.
And are you getting information fed back from the guys around you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the guys that are under contact and like they're firing back at the enemy and stuff, I'll just be like, well, where is the fellow? And you just say, look, he's just right up there. That's the area where the fire was coming from. So I'd bit like a grid, as a direction and stuff to it, and then I'll get the mortars ready to fire. Might necessarily, might not fire on it, just so that they're ready then to fire into there if anything happens. But then things sort of died down, and it was later on in the afternoon again, and then we're up in a compound on the roof and stuff, and all hell broke loose again. The whoosh of RPGs and cracks and stuff of rounds coming. But then the Apaches were called in and then stopped anything happening from there.
When you spoke, what kind of equipment are you carrying to do your job when you're on the ground?
My radio, with communication to my Alpha and to the mortar line. I've got binos, I've got a spugger, which is some form of GPS, but it's obviously the army do things in big and bulk and heavy, don't they? So it's like a big GPS sort of thing, and that'd like give me my grid and stuff like that. Water, had loads of water, ammunition, and that was it.
Do you carry maps at all?
The bare minimum, sorry.
Do you carry maps at all?
Yeah, and obviously I'd have my map in my side pocket, just the easy access and stuff, and obviously nothing else, just water, ammunition, and my binos were wrapped around my neck. I mean, they've got a lot of kit hanging off me and stuff, and yeah, it all helped out, and yeah, it's heavy, like, because you're carrying quite a lot of water, obviously, the amount of water you take on is crazy, because you're just constantly sweating, no matter what you do, you're sweating, even if you're sitting down, you're sweating, you know, so constant water intake, and obviously ammunition and rations and stuff as well, so yeah, there's a good old 60, 70 pounds for carrying on your back and stuff, and running with that as well. I will say though, when you're in a contact and stuff, that weight goes, you can't even feel it. It's adrenaline kicks in, you can't feel nothing.
How did that contact start when you were in the poppy field? What was it? Was it just, I'm trying to get a feel for how something like that starts off in the first place.
Well, we got dropped off by the Royal Marines, obviously in their Viking vehicles on the high ground. What the operation was, we were going to patrol from the high ground through the fields and go into like the little town and say there's a few compounds that we're going to check, and then we're going to see if there's any people around so we could just get some information and stuff, you know, do the whole heart and minds and stuff like that. The first thing, obviously, you've probably heard about it on the news, when you come in to the town, there was no one there. That's a combat indicator to say the Taliban are there, ready to ambush. Then anything, no, maybe they won't. There was stuff on Icon chatter saying there, Taliban are there. And then obviously no civilians around, and yeah, something's going to happen. I'll tell you what, step straight off into the poppy field, and that was it. RPGs washing past and bullets cracking and stuff like that. So yeah, obviously they were waiting there for an ambush, and we took them on and we won the firefight.
In the compounds, do they tend to occupy compounds and fire back at you?
Yeah, but the other thing as well, they'll hide in mosques. Okay, they'll hide in a mosque, they'll fire from a mosque. Us being the British Army and stuff, and the rules that we follow within this job, we're not allowed to fire back on that mosque. We're not allowed to blow that mosque up. But obviously, most people think, well, look, they're using that as a fire support where they're firing from. Some people would just flatten that. Well, they're using it, they're firing at us, trying to kill us. Well, some people have probably a different attitude and think, well, we're going to fire back at the mosque. And we blow the mosque up and stuff. But obviously, British Army, we have to follow rules and stuff. And obviously we didn't, we had to wait until they moved away from there, but yeah, they'll hide up in the mosque because they know that we won't fire into that mosque. They're sneaky. Clever, but they're sneaky as well.
And you said there was, that you got air support obviously from the Apaches. What were the types of air support you would get? Would it be purely Apaches or could you get other?
Probably Apaches was the more fire support because it was quicker, a lot quicker. The thing is though, you don't have them for long. But they'll swap around and stuff. I mean, we could call fast air, and but where we were, like the situation, it was only a little compound. We weren't far from it, so we thought, no, obviously not going to call in a massive 500-pound bomb on that, are they? They're just going to call in an Apache just to give it hellfire, which it did. It took them out.
And with the compounds, are they... Because I know they're made of mud and brick,
yeah.
But do they take the impact of rounds quite well?
Yeah, they do. It's crazy, because when you go in and you see how thick they actually are, it's just nuts, it's just mad. Bullets will go hit them, but they won't go through them. And that's from a 50 cal. 50 cals cannot penetrate in compounds. What most we have to do most of the time is get the engineers to set up a little bar mine and blow it through like that. And even sometimes that will just shake the wall and won't even break it. It's crazy how that Apache's 50 cal fire or whatever will penetrate armour but won't penetrate mud. It's nuts. It's crazy just to think that. But yeah, they're thick. So thick. Makes you see the thickness of them. I mean, there's clay, straw, and probably everything else. They can just chuck them in like rocks and stuff. Yeah, the engineers used to get us into them with their little bar mines after a couple of goes and then we'd be in them.
So after did the operation die down a little bit once the Apache had been called in?
That was it. There was nothing else for the rest of the day, and probably nothing else for the rest of that op, for that rest of that week. It was just them hearts and minds. See, there, you've been fighting, and then you have to switch straight back to the action of hearts and minds. You know, you've just been aggressive fighting and stuff, and then you think, well, and then you've got to do hearts and minds now. So you're there, you've aggressive fighting all morning and stuff, and then you have to, like, obviously, we're trying to do it, but you need to switch your head back over to then hearts and minds, and that there's no more threat, and other people come up to you now, isn't there, threat and stuff. You know.
How easy is that to do?
It's quite hard, actually. you just have your killing head on and stuff, haven't you? You've been in contacts for hours and stuff, putting down loads of fire and stuff, and probably having close calls and stuff like that, and then when that dies down, you're going to have to switch over to do the hearts and minds job of it as well, or speak to the elders and stuff. I mean, yes, well, we got used to it after a while. It's pretty hard.
After the sanguine thing, were you pulled out after that operation?
Yeah, we pulled out up to the high ground. The company and the fire support of B Company were then staying there for another 24 hours before they were going to move to Fort Robinson to then do a move to back to Bastion. I got flown out by a chopper because I was on R&R for a couple of days, so I was happy to get on that chopper and see you later, I'm going home for a couple of weeks.
So, again, is that a difficult thing to do? To go from that environment where you're being shot at and, you know, you're doing the hearts and minds and being shot at and that sort of thing, and then to come back to the UK?
And you come back to the UK. I don't know, I was happy. I was going out to Scotland to see my mum and stuff. And everything was cool, but yeah, when... It was still there, and now you're still thinking of it, still constantly thinking, oh man, I can't believe what I've just been doing for the last couple of months. And telling that story to your parents and to like your loved ones and stuff, and you're like, what the hell? And actually how it is. I mean, they didn't have a clue.
Well, at that time, there's a bit of a, I was going to say a bit of a backlog before the news really gets through what people are doing, isn't there, in that sort of situation. So, was it the fact that nobody actually really quite understood what you've been doing or how you've been doing it or what the situation was.
Yeah, they didn't know what the ops and stuff were doing. Obviously, all you hear on the news is there's a death. And then you can let you know if anything about the casualties and stuff, you know. We'll go on to that in a minute because I came a casualty myself. But all you're going to hear about is the deaths. That's the only thing that makes the news, which is, I just hate it. I just think they should mention casualties, maybe not all or by name and stuff, but give them some sort of mention, say, okay, B Company today, breaking news, B Company today had a massive firefight after doing a hearts and minds operation. They took several casualties. They're all believed to be okay and stuff, and in good hands in hospitals and stuff like that, and then go on a little bit about why they've done that, like that op and stuff. I mean, they can't give out a lot, can they, just publicity and stuff. But they could do a bit more than just today the soldier is killing one lady and go on to something else, go on to something else, and he doesn't even get a big story.
Did you see any media out there? I mean, obviously Ross Kemp was out there for certain parts of it, but
Ross Kemp was still out there.
There was nobody else.
He was behind me most of the time, on the ops and stuff. So yeah, that's all I saw right then.
There was no major TV companies with you at all?
There probably was out there, but there was none with us. Because when we were on the ground and stuff, it was just Ross Kemp and then... maybe back in Bastion there was some media and stuff, but...
Okay, so what happened after you'd been in Sangam? In your hour and a half, you were back?
Back, and back into swing things. So I'd come back to Bastion, I had 2 days in Bastion. I thought I was going to have like a week, because like, there was a knock going on at the time, and there was this new place called Fox, which was a new patrol base. Where B Company were, but at this time B Company was split up, half were in Kajaki Dam, and then half was still in Fort Fox doing patrols out of there. So yeah, I just had our depressed as hell, and then I got told that in a couple of days I'm flying into Fort Fox, because I got to take over my Alpha MSC, who was then going on R&R, and I was then stepping up to do his job as well. So. I got flown into Fog Fox, obviously we just passed each other, and high five, and he was laughing obviously because I was back there and he was then leaving, so he was happy and stuff. For about a day or so, I think, I didn't do anything, I just kicked, just slept, just chatting with the guys on the mortar line and stuff, and then we had a briefing that we were going out on a patrol, and this was going to start before Gashagar operation, the day before Gashagar operation. And what we were doing, we went out to watch the Sangam River the night before the ops starts, just to see if there's any people crossing. Like we were going there as like a snap ambush or so. We were there as an ambush, nothing happened. I mean, starting to break morning and stuff, we then set off on foot. There was a few other tasks that the B Company commander was wanted us to do, the normal compound checking and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, all hell broke loose again. There were 360 around us, I can remember that. I remember like the whole of B Company, we were just like one big snake in the riverbed, like with water up to our chests, and the Taliban were in front, behind, at each side and stuff. I don't know how many there was, or how they were split down and stuff, but I can remember just being crazy, just surround us full 360, and then I was up calling in fire missions and stuff. I was calling in HE and smoke, like only 100 metres away from like, us lot. But I had to call it in danger place because we were just pinned down for ages. And that went on for probably most of the day. Yeah, most of the day that went on for, into the late evening and stuff. And then obviously we found the compound. Done our stags and stuff and slept, and then we went into Gashagar the next day. And then the morning started relatively quiet, and then we found a bunker full of ammunition and stuff. And at this point as well, there was dead Taliban all around us, so they were either preparing for an ambush or we caught them in the act trying to retrieve their ammunition. So the engineers blew it up and the load. Cleaned the bodies up and stuff.
What did the Taliban look like?
Not that much different from us. I mean, they had some of them had like green kit on, like combats and stuff. Some of them had chest rigs with ammunition, AKs, obviously ammunition in there. Then there was some just in like their. Normal clothing, what the civil, like the locals were wearing and stuff, and their flip flops and stuff. But some of them had headdress on, some of them didn't. Some of them just looked like normal people, like a normal soldier, like Pakistani soldier with just belt kit on, ammunition and combats.
And are some of them foreign fighters as such?
Yeah, well that was the thing. I mean, believe whatever's going on, but they mainly recruit from the border of Pakistan anyway, so there could be people from Pakistan, there could be people from anywhere around and stuff. It's just that sort of thing, you just don't know. actually where they're all from. I mean, some of them there were just, I mean, there was just even like a little kid, he must have been about 13 or something, and he was probably just with his dad fighting and stuff. One of them looked really young, but 13, that shocked me to see a 13-year-old fight. But you hear about it, you hear about the little kids not even being suicide bombers and stuff like that. So, yeah, they, some were combats and some were just dressed as locals.
So was that, those were the people you'd obviously been in contact with the day before, were they?
Yeah, probably. And they probably were treating their ammunition and they were caught in the act. Shooting and screaming, obviously, they were killed in the firefight when we took the firearms to them.
So you're moving through into the town, are you? That's it.
Yeah, we're moving up to a point where we all need to catch our breath. The OCs took us, like, stop. We had a little lunch break, if you like. It was quiet now anyway. It's been quiet for a good couple of hours. I mean, the patrols out there take forever because you're constantly checking. And to walk 100 metres could take you an hour, you know. You just don't know what's going to happen and stuff. So you take them like a little break and stuff. Nothing on the intercom. All quiet rounds. Still no local people though. Just the odd couple just clearing up the bodies. I can remember just sitting like, on the riverbank. Like, we had compounds all around us and stuff. Just sitting there, just out of the sun and stuff, just catching your breath, having some food and stuff, like, adminning ourselves and stuff. And then, you know, so he was briefing up the other commanders on the next task, what was going ahead, what was going to clear out some compounds and stuff. Find somewhere to kick for the night and just patrol out for 24 hours. This was the start of Kashagar as well, so that was going on. I was on the radio to Mortis, so like, yeah, we're now moving off on task. As I got up to stand out of the way, like to walk off, an RPG come out of nowhere, it smashed the bank, and I got the full blast of it onto my leg. That took me right off my legs. I can remember just thinking, oh man, what the hell. At the time of the point, it must have been adrenaline hitting me, because I didn't really feel any pain. Well, I managed to pick myself up and I just ran, got up on my feet and just ran back into the ditch. And then I had medics and everyone around me and stuff. But yeah, it came out of nowhere, it hit the bank. Didn't get anyone else, I got the full blast of, like, off the shrapnel and stuff or whatever it was. I can remember I was laying there for a good 45 minutes. I had a tourniquet applied on my leg first, but they took it off. I didn't really need it on there, they just covered it up with the first little dressing. Once you've done all the the radio and on to the sergeant majors, who are usually the people in charge of the Cadillacs from the green zone, I then was put on a poncho, like they used it instead of a stretcher. And I was Cadillac for about 1,000 metres back onto the main road where a vehicle could pick me up and take me to the heavy landing site so I could be Cadillac back to the bastion. While I had Cadillac in there, they were doing it under fire, and the Taliban then opened up, obviously, probably just to see that we're in a bit of predicament that they were capping to Cadillac somewhere. And I think they were trying to pop off the people carrying me and probably me as well. But then, wrecking on the high ground, then located the fire position and just got blitzed. All I can remember on that, because obviously they applied morphine and stuff, I was just half asleep on the candy bag, just feeling all comfy and stuff, you know, I was just ready, I was like, well, anything's going to happen now, well, I'm ready to go, I'm just comfy. And then got me on a vehicle, chopper was there, I can remember getting on the chopper, I can remember taking off and having to turn round and come back again to pick up some Americans that had been injured as well. So we've done that. There was like four Americans on there. There was me. There was another lad that went down with heat exhaustion. He was unconscious. I can remember him working on him, trying to get a response from him. And then there was another lad that got shot in the arm. That was just sitting with me, and I was just lying there. I put more morphine for a drip when I was on the chopper. And then I remember it just being packed full of people. And it was just mad. So obviously, I've always thought, oh, I wonder what it's like for them people working on these choppers, how chaotic it is in there when they've got those casualties in there. You see a saw, it's just mad. People running around checking people and stuff and trying to get a response out of people and stuff like that. And then we landed at Bastion, and then I went into straight into emergency operating. Just what they didn't realise when I got hit, not the main wound, but I got hit behind the knee, which I hit an artery, so I was bleeding to death at the time. So they got me straight into theatre, into operating theatre to stop the bleeding. And then I woke up on the ward. And I had someone come up to me, obviously explain what happened and stuff. I was out of it. I mean, more thing, I was just not with it at all. And I was like that for 2 days. I had to have a blood transfusion, so I lost quite a lot of blood for the artery that hit. The next day, a few of my mates come in, B company, a whole section got hit from an RPG, and they got all pulled in here. I remember that. I can remember at the time, like, being in the hospital bed. I don't know how much this is true. I had a little girl next to me. It was a civilian little girl. Half her arm was missing. She was caught in some bomb, some explosion and stuff. And at the other end, I think it was a Taliban. I'm sure they said it was a Taliban at the end of the room. He had a very bad attitude towards the nurses. He wouldn't let them feed him. He didn't want them to touch him or nothing. And it was constantly staring, like giving emails and stuff towards us. So yeah, it was either a local that was upset that it was Taliban, but a lot of people saying it was Taliban. But that we treated Taliban as well. And then I was coming back to the UK.
Where did you go to when you got back?
Straight to St Edmunds Hospital in Birmingham.
How was your leg at that stage? Because obviously
it was in a bad way. They didn't do a lot. All they could do was cut off the artery and tie it or do whatever they had, restitch it up or something. My leg at the time had a lot of infection and stuff in it, obviously because of the shrapnel and stuff. The first few days in Birmingham were a blur. I mean, I was in and out of theatre one day, and then I was back in operation theatre again, so cutting away muscle and dead flesh and cutting away the infection and stuff. And my girlfriend at the time, she was in Canada, she's Canadian. She just got back from R&R, like she'd come over to meet me for R&R. She got back to Canada a couple of days later, she had to turn and come back again. My mum and everyone come down, it was just all a blur really. Like the first couple of days I was in and out of theatre. I must have had about 5 ops in about the first week that I was in Birmingham. And then once I was stable, they had me up on a military ward where there's all like just military, not civvies. So everyone around there is like all military, and like they're good old military banter and stuff, and all telling each other what's happening and stuff to each other. We've still got all the people you can talk to.
Is that a good thing actually, that not being on mixed ward?
It's not civvies like there. Like, oh, where was that doing and stuff like that, and you're speaking to them, like, I don't know. It's just better just to have military surrounding you. Just because. I don't know, it's just one of the things, isn't it? You just want to be surrounded by your own. Yeah, I was in there for about 2 months, but I had major infections. I had a machine on my leg. And yeah, it was really pretty bad leg to start off with.
How was your leg now?
I had an operation in November last year to straighten out my tendons. Got major tendon damage at the minute, tearing my scar tissue and stuff. It's a lot better than it was, but it's. My toes are still curled because of the tightness of the tendons and stuff. And the wound where they hit is fine, it's just the aftermath now, like the tendons and the bone. Half of my bone, like on my down the bottom of my fib and my tibia has all been chopped away, so I've got a little gap between the bones at the minute. But I'm getting there slowly.
Are you obviously hoping to carry on?
I'm hoping to get back to as good as fitness as I can, then look at my options. If that means staying or getting out and starting a different life somewhere else. But at the minute I'm in 2 miles and I'm not sure yet, just depending on the injury and how much we'll recover from it.
Thanks, Donnie.